Boker Tov to everybody. Good morning. Welcome on a beautiful Yerushalmi summer day. Perfect temperature and hopefully some Talmud Torah as well. Last week we spoke about an area that Israel is somewhat behind the world in. Maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing. We spoke about that last week, which is organ donation. And we said that compared to the rest of the world, Israel has a very small number of people who carry organ donor cards. And in that sense, there's a feel that there needs to be a catch-up in that area. Today, this week, I want to speak about an area in which Israel is way ahead of the rest of the world, which is in fertility treatments, in helping people to conceive, in finding new and innovative ways to create families. This is something, obviously, as Jewish people, that we are absolutely focused on. We want to build families, we want to help people. But also, in particular, hashkafically, we'll see, this area in particular is one in which we really wish to try and promote. It's a mitzvah, a peruvu, to produce families, etc. And I'd like to start with this issue of the hashkafa, and then go on to talk about the issues specifically surrounding surrogacy. We're going to have a bit of fun today. There are quite a lot of very interesting sources which are going to take us all round on a magical mystery tour of Shach. You're going to see some things that I'm sure you will remember because they're very strange. But nevertheless, strange is not bad. Strange can be very helpful, and they will hopefully put the pieces together for us. First of all, as I'm sure you're aware, there are many and various different methods these days to try and help people to conceive and have children. It used to be, back in the old-fashioned days, that in order to produce a child, you need a man and a woman. That is no longer so straightforward anymore. There are multiple potential partners in producing children, and there are different types of treatment. I've just listed at the bottom of the first page, we'll look at the sources there in a second. There is obviously internal medical treatment, intervention, hormonal treatment. There's a lot of research and developments on that as well, helping people to balance their hormones in a way that they can conceive. There's artificial insemination, where the husband can provide the sperm and the wife can be artificially inseminated in a way that assists fertilization. That's fairly old technology. There's IVF, in vitro fertilization, which is also colloquially known as test tube babies back in the day. People have been fertilizing test tube babies for a long time now, since the 1970s. And there are millions, literally millions and millions of people in the world who have been produced by IVF, where you take an ovum from the mother and you take sperm from the father and you fertilize the embryos in lab conditions. And then usually you implant them back into the mother, and that way the mother can carry the child and the fertilization process was assisted. However, when you add to IVF surrogacy, meaning you take the gestational mother who is not the genetic mother at all, let's say, for example, the genetic mother has a problem carrying a baby. She could produce eggs and the husband produces sperm. In that sense, they're totally fertile. But the mother has a syndrome of some kind that she doesn't have an active and functioning uterus. There are a number of syndromes like this. I've mentioned one or two here. In that situation, there's no point doing IVF and then putting the embryo back into the genetic mother. It won't succeed. In that situation, you need a surrogate mother, or these days called a gestational mother, who will, if you like, it's a kind of rent-a-womb situation, where she will act as almost like an incubator for the baby, and then give birth to the baby, or babies, and then she will give them back to the genetic mother. In this sense, the genetic mother and the genetic father bring up the children, they look like them, they talk like them, they act like them, they're part of their house. But there was another woman involved. There was a gestational mother who gave birth to these children. And the question is, does she in any way become part of the halachic formula? Does she have some say in being a mother of the children or not? We'll have to have a look at that. There are other things as well these days. There are egg donors, where a woman can donate an egg. Just like men can donate sperm, you can have ED, which is egg donation. And then you have a question, does the genetic egg, if you like, that comes from another mother, does she somewhere on a database that we don't necessarily know where or who she is, does she figure in the spectrum as well? You can have now ovarian transplants, where an ovary is actually transplanted into another woman. That's relatively recent technology. And you can now have mitochondrial donors. What's a mitochondrial donor? So I'm not a scientist, and I'm sure there are scientists and medical professionals here that will correct me if I'm wrong, but there's obviously a lot of DNA in the cell, and the DNA is quite well known. That it codes, if you like, the reproduction of the new person. But in the nucleus itself, there are small little organs. There is a theory that these were originally a different species, whatever. I'm not getting into that now. But now they live inside us, millions and billions of them, called mitochondria. And the mitochondria have their own distinct DNA. And there are certain medical conditions where there is a problem with the mitochondrial DNA. And therefore, you could have somebody who donates an egg, somebody else who donates mitochondrial DNA for that, and somebody else who is the gestational mother who carries the baby. And then you then have potentially three women who have contributed to creating that child. This, as you can imagine, is getting now very complicated. Cloning is just around the corner. Officially, we're not meant to be cloning people. We've cloned all sorts of things. I don't remember Dolly the sheep. Some years ago. We haven't heard much more about future dollies, but that probably means that it's all happening outside, you know, not in the news. But they may well be cloning people, and what will be when they clone people? Who will they be related to? If somebody clones me, that sounds like a frightening prospect, but if somebody clones me, are they my son? Is the clone my son? Is it my twin? Is it my brother? Is it me? What is that? Is it alive? Does it have an ashamah? Does he count for a minion? There are going to be people calling, no? In 20, 30 years, there are going to be people calling rabbis saying, listen, rabbi, it's nearly Shkia, we need to daven mincha, we've got 9 guys and a clone. Yes or no? You watch this space. You watch this space, it'll happen soon. So, these are all questions that we need to address. Today I'm focusing mostly on surrogacy, not on the other questions. But we'll learn from that, hopefully, to the others too. The first 2 points I want to make before you turn over the page, just stay on page 1 for a second. You've seen these sources actually before when we talked about cosmetic surgery. The question is, are we playing God in some sense? You see, this is a phrase which is used in the media a lot. Oh, playing God, and what does that mean? We don't really have a concept of quote-unquote playing God. It's not a theological term anyway. It was invented by the media. On the contrary, insofar as we can help people, we will help people. As long as it is halakhically permissible, that's the $64,000 question, we don't have a problem in principle. Looking at number 1 for a second, we won't read the whole thing. We've seen it before. This is a question. The Turnus Rufus asked, the Roman asked Rabbi Akiva. Now this Midrashic formula where Turnus Rufus is speaking to Rabbi Akiva, it's presented, if you like, by Chazal as a classic debate between the Jewish and the non-Jewish position. The Jewish and the Roman, or Western, we might call it now, position. If you claim that your God loves poor people, why does he give them no money? Why are they poor if he loves them so much? So Rabbi Akiva replied, so that we can give them money, and that can be a schus for us, and we can help them, and we ourselves can help ourselves as well. So Amalei, he responded to him, Adarabba, on the contrary, by helping these people, you should go to Gehenna. How dare you help the poor people? Said Turnus Rufus. I'll give you a marshal. What is this similar to? A king is angry with his servant, and he throws him in jail. He says no one has to help him, no one has to give him food. And someone goes behind the king's back and gives him food. When the king hears about this, will he not explode with rage? You are called Avadim. You, the Jewish people, are Avadim of Hashem, Libanei Yisrael Avadim, and therefore how can you go against God's plan? God has an eternal plan. He's decided these people are poor, these people are sick. When a poor person comes to my door, why don't I answer the door and say, look, listen, I understand your situation, but who am I to interfere with God's eternal plan?
He wants you to have no money and me to have more money, and that's obviously how it's beshed, it's meant to be. Chas v'shalom, Rabbi Akiva replies, that's not how we look at it. And Rabbi Akiva responds, I'm not going through the whole source, that we're also called banim, not just avadim, we're children of God, all human beings are children of God to some degree, and therefore the more that we help each other, even though that's not the way the world was made, that is surely what God is going to take nachas from, in that sense, that we help each other, and therefore God forbid that we turn around to a poor person or a sick person and say, this is decreed. We say, we don't know how God runs the world, that's for God to run the world, but we do know if we can help, and if we can help, we will help. And in fact, even more than this, Chazal said in number 2, Philosoph Echad Shalit Rebbe Hoshaya, one philosopher asked Rebbe Hoshaya, Amalei Im Chaviva Hi Amila, if Bris Mila is so special, Mipnei Ma Loi Nitna La'Adam Arishin, why was man not created with a Bris Mila? We're so excited, Bris Mila is the sign between man and God, between us and God. Amalei said, Rabbi Shaya turned to him and said, Kol Masha Nivra B'Sheisha Shemei B'Reshit Tzrichi Nasiya. Everything that was created in the natural world needs something to perfect it. And he gives an example. Kagan Chardal Tzarech L'Mtok. Mustard needs a little bit of seasoning. Hatur Mitin Tzarech L'Mtok. You know, everything needs a little something. My grandmother, Alei HaShalom, used to say, an egg is perfect, just needs a little salt. And that's it. I don't know if you can still say you put salt in things anymore, but that was back in the day when people put salt in things, okay? Afilu Adam Tzarech Tikkun, even a person needs a tikkun, and therefore we are in this world to do tikkun olam. And if we find people who we can help, we're not going to get upset by playing God. That's not a Jewish concept. If it's halakhically and hashkafically appropriate, we will intervene wherever possible. And if you flip over the page, please, to page number 2, there are a number of issues. It's not straightforward. I've written down a number of ethical issues. I'm not giving a share on ethics today, but there are things that you can read there. The commercialization of reproduction. Is it appropriate that women should charge money to give their eggs or charge money to rent out their wombs? Is this in some way degrading? Is this turning women into incubators? Is this inappropriate? Rav Jacobovitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, many years ago, before really this took off, had some very negative things ethically to say about turning women into incubators. Are women being exploited in the Far East, in Asia? There are baby farms where women are kept effectively in slavery and are used to produce children in order to give to Western families, etc. There are clearly major ethical problems that one has to be aware of. It's not so straightforward. Do the poor have access to this technology as much as the rich? And there are other things there that I've talked about. But the halakhic issues interest me and us, I think, more today. And I've listed 9, and I'm going to focus on a few of them in this year. First of all, we have to work out who's related to whom. In this particular case, let me give you the example of the mother, the surrogate mother. You have a genetic mother who has donated the egg. You have a birth mother, gestational mother, who has carried the child and given birth. Which of those is the mother? There are a number of consequences to this. Obviously, kibud av va'em, also inheritance. More importantly, who's related to who, halakhically? Meaning, if a woman is very good at having surrogate babies, she loves having babies, and she helps half a dozen different families by carrying their babies. If she is the mother, in some halakhic sense, of these children, and they're all now scattered to the winds, they're all siblings. And we need to keep a track of that, because we need to know if they're going to marry each other. And you say, oh, well, what are the chances? You know something? You never know. Things happen. I have a situation in my own family that I'm not getting into the whole details, but we had a very near miss. One of my cousins, my mother's cousin actually, was a single child, was an only child, and when her parents were very old, eventually they passed away, and she went through the parents' stuff to, you know, tidy up the house and what have you, clear out the things. She found a birth certificate for a brother that she never knew she had. What had happened? So my great uncle and great aunt, without going into any details, this was back in the 1930s, 40s, had managed to have a child between each other before they got married. Okay? And this, of course, was scandalous. And the child was given up for adoption. It was not appropriate to keep the child. In those days, the child was given away for adoption. You couldn't trace the child. You couldn't find out where it went. And the child couldn't trace its parents. And that was it. It was forgotten, brushed under the carpet, that nobody ever knew. Okay? Actually, it's very interesting. When I found out about this a few years ago, I called my parents and said, "You'll never guess what I've just found out." My parents said to me, "Oh, yes, everybody knows about that." I said, "So, anything else you'd like to tell me about while we're talking, you know?" You never know. But what happened eventually is this child was put up for adoption locally, and the local authority in England said, "Oh, a little Jewish baby. We don't get many Jewish babies. We'll give it to a Jewish family that wants adoption." And this child, unbeknown to anybody, was given to a family down the road from my cousin, and they hung out together as teenagers. They were in the same youth group, they went together and everything, and when she found out later, when she traced him, she discovered that this was her full brother, her full genetic brother. She nearly fell over. She said, "We could have got married. We were friendly with each other." And you never know what's going to happen. Yes?
Did you say the surrogate's children
are siblings? No. We'll see. We'll have to ask. We'll have to ask. We have to deal with that question. What is the status? I had an older lady come up to me at the end of the shiur once many years ago. And she said to me, she just had shiva for her sister. I said, "I'm very sorry." She said, "Until she has a question." She said, "Does an adopted child have to sit shiva for her adopting mother?" So I said, I mean, I can't possibly answer that question in a vacuum. You know, what's the situation? And explain to me. So she said, "Listen, I have a very elderly mother, okay, in her late 90s. And as I said, I just sat shiva for my sister. We were at the shiva and somebody came along with some old pictures from the old days, like people do at a shiva. And someone produced a picture," she said, "of my mother with a date on it that was dated 3 weeks before I was born, and my mother was not pregnant. And I presented this to my mother," said the lady, "and said, 'What's this?' And her mother went pale and said, 'I thought you'd never know, but you're all adopted. The whole family was adopted. Your sister was adopted. You were adopted. I never told you. I never wanted you to find out. And now at this stage, 60 something years later, she finds out.' So you never know what's going to go on with people. That is obviously a major question." Yes?
In London, you had to tell the fact.
You had to tell them where the family...
Yes. I know such a similar case.
Right.
And the fact they knew who...
They kept tabs on it, so that if they're... Right. That's fine if they get married in London, but what happens if they go and live in Los Angeles and the London Mason's not involved anymore? These days, everyone's everywhere. So that's one question. We have a question about pru revu. If a person creates children through this, if you like, medical intervention, does that somehow detach them from pru revu if it wasn't in the natural way? There are questions of how to obtain sperm. I'm not getting into that today. There are questions of inseminating a woman. Let's say if the wife is a nida, is that a problem then that she became pregnant, even though obviously it was in medical conditions? Is that an issue? What if the donor of the sperm or the donor of the egg is themselves a mamzel? What does that do to the status of the child, and will we ever know? Is it possible for a married woman to another man to act as a surrogate for a different man's child? Is that some kind of almost adultery, even though, of course, they never touched each other in their lives? Okay? And many other questions come up as well, using the sperm from a Cohen with a divorcee. There are many questions that come up. And I'd like to deal with the surrogate case. The surrogate case basically works. I brought you various cases on the bottom. The surrogate case, just to reiterate, it works as follows. You have a situation where a woman gives her egg and a man gives the sperm, and they fertilize them in lab conditions and they implant them into a surrogate gestational mother. This happens all the time. Now, it is a common procedure, but it is not at all rare these days. And I know a number of people who are in their late teens now who already 20 years ago this was happening. Who is the halakhic mother? Let's ask that question today. Is it the birth mother? Is it the gestational mother? In a quite well-known case that happened in England some years ago, so in that case the genetic mother was Jewish, the birth mother was a non-Jewish woman, and the question is, when the babies are born, do they need to be converted? Are they non-Jewish and need conversion? In a case where the father is a Kohen, are the babies Kohanim? Meaning, if the genetic mother is the mother, then the babies are born from a Jewish mother and they may well be Kohanim. If the actual halachic mother is the surrogate mother, who was not Jewish, and the kids are converted, you can't have a convert who's a Kohen. So the father will be a Kohen, but the children will not be Kohanim. I actually know of another situation where
they're actually Levian. And he married the wife. She was not Jewish, and he was not religious. And he married the wife when she was not Jewish, and they had a child. And then she converted Reform, and he married her again, and they had another child. She converted Conservative, they married again. She converted Orthodox, they married again. This family now have a selection of children, some of whom are Levian, some of whom are Israeli, some of whom are not Jewish at all. Like, you can end up with these interesting families. Until recently, it was thought that the surrogate mother is basically just an incubator. She just takes it and she gives it back. Recently, and I brought you a reference to an article by Rav Moshe Tendler at the bottom, I'm not quoting from the article today, but recently they discovered that actually a lot more goes on between the surrogate mother, the gestational mother, and the embryo than they thought, even though they're not genetically connected. They have discovered that a lot of cells, stem cells, pass across the placenta between the host mother, let's call her, which go into the fetus, even though it's not her genetic baby, and the other way around. A baby inside the womb of a mother sends a lot of cells across the placenta into the mother, into the host mother, and they stay with her for life. And actually, there's a lot of interesting research into Alzheimer's that they've discovered that it could be that stem cells from male children protect in some way against Alzheimer's because they're with you for life. If you are a woman, which some of you are, if you don't know, then that's a question you should ask someone else, not me. But you are carrying stem cells from yourself, from your parents, and from your mother, and from your children. And therefore, they have discovered this connection between the host mother and this embryo, which maybe indicates a lot more going on there than we thought. Let's have a look at some sources and see if we can work out something of an answer. We're not going to get a definitive answer, but I'd like to show you around the sugya and help you work things out. First of all, let's talk about genetics.
Another question,
pigeon or ben? What's that? Pigeon or ben? Absolutely, pigeon or ben, not a cohen. What about genetics? Are we interested in genetics? Now, let me first of all point out that it's very clear that in a number of cases, the genetic parents are not the halachic parents, and that is in the situation of a conversion. Have a look in number 3. The Gemara in Yevamah says, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Ger Shen Yizgayer Kekotan Shenoy Lagam. If a convert, for non-Jew, converts to Judaism, the child is like a katan shenolav, a newborn child. It's a new slate. They are no longer related, technically and halachically, to the non-Jewish parents that originally gave birth to them. Now, of course, that doesn't mean they can't be connected with them socially and friendly, and they can visit them at Christmas or whatever it is, okay? But they are not the same halachic, they're not their halachic parents. They don't have halachic parents, okay? Because they are like a cotton shinola dummy. If you follow that through, logically, what would happen if an entire family converts? And this happens. The father and the mother. You have a father, Roger, is married to Christine, and they have 2 children, Patrick and Mary. Okay? Just to make the case clear, okay? Roger, Christine, Patrick and Mary all convert to Judaism. And now, Roger is Reuven, and Christine is Hannah, and Patrick is Pinchas, and Mary is Miriam. Very nice. They're all one big happy Jewish family. But you know something? Nobody's related to anybody. Because when they all converted, they all became newborn children. Look at number 4. The Shulchan Aruch reports this case. Din Torah, according to the strict letter of the law, says the Shulchan Aruch, Shemutu leger sheyisa imok. A convert could marry his mother converted, or a choisamim, or his sister, Shengar, if they all convert. In theory, they can all marry each other, they're not related. But of course, we do not allow this. Aval chachamim asru davazeh, the rabbi said, no way. Kadesh lo yomru, we don't want them to say, banu mi kedusha chamuru le kedusha kala. We used to be non-Jews and we couldn't marry our siblings. Now we're Jewish, everything's hefka. Meaning you know and I know, they're not really siblings halachically, but it doesn't feel right on any level at all, and therefore the rabbi said, you can't do that. But you see here, for starters, that genetics does not necessarily determine who the parents are, and therefore in our case of surrogacy, we're going to have to ask, does it or doesn't it? I would like to bring you a number of sources now that indicate that birth may determine the maternity. And in fact, when the whole issue of surrogacy first started becoming more common, this was the general position that the poskim took.
There has been something of a switch around, we'll talk about that soon, but the general position that most people, if you read Rabbi J. David Bleich, he takes this position very clearly, Rabbi Moshe Tendler also takes this position, that the birth mother is the halachic mother, which will mean, in my scenario where you have a non-Jewish surrogate, the babies have to be converted in that particular case, because they won't be born Jewish, which of course they can do, but there are implications. Technically, a baby who is converted at birth has to be given an option. How we do this is, I'm not getting to now, whether they wish to remain Jewish or not remain Jewish. That's obviously major when they get to Bar Mitzvah. Have a look here at these sources that indicate that birth may determine the maternity. First of all, let's start in the Agadita. And we'll talk in a minute about whether Midrashim and Agaditas are legitimate sources for this. Dina. This is a very famous case. Dina is, of course, the daughter of Leah and Yaakov. And the Pasuk says in 5, Achar, Ba'achar Yalda Bat, and afterwards, we'll have to ask after what, she had a daughter, Batikra et Shma Dina. And she called the name of the daughter Dina. Now there are a few things with that verse. First of all, what's Ba'achar? After what? Second of all, why Dina? Dina is a strange name. It means justice. Why call your kid justice? Okay, if you're the Amish or whatever, the kids are called chastity and charity. You know, justice is very nice. Okay, but it's a strange name for a little Jewish girl. Okay. Furthermore, every time Leah gives the child a name, and Rachel for that matter, there's a reason behind the name. Reuben, because God should see me, and Shimon, God should hear me, etc., etc. My husband should see me and hear me. So the Gemara in Brachas picks up in number 6 the following interesting agadita. Look at number 6 with me. My va'achar. What does it mean? And afterwards, I'm a Rav. So Rav says the following: La'achar shedana leya din ba'atzma. She went through a personal din. What was this din? This judgment. Va'amra, and she said, 12 tribes are coming from Yaakov. Shisha yatsu mimenu. 6 have already come from me. She's already had Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zvulun. That's a done deal. There are already 6. The arba min hashvachot. 4 have already come out from the shvachot. There's only 2 left to go. Hari asara. That's 10 down. 2 to go. In Zeh Zachar, if this child, says Leah, is another boy, my 7th boy, Lo Tehei Achoisi Rachel Ka'achat HaShvachot, then there'll only be 1 boy left, and my sister Rachel, who's not yet become pregnant, will have 1 boy out of 12, less than even the maidservants, Pasnish. I don't want that. Miyad Nefcha Lebat. The baby changed from a boy to a girl. Shneema, Vatikra et Shema Dina, meaning she sees now that she has a baby girl and she says, oh, Dina, that's fair. That's what, that's justice. I'm happy now I have a girl. Yaakov can have, Rachel can have the boy. Okay, very nice. That doesn't seem to say anything about surrogacy or embryo. They switch the gender. How exactly that happens? Good question. Meaning, it's not exactly clear medically at the beginning of a conception what gender the child will be. Obviously there are chromosomes in the child, but there's a lot of hormonal stuff that needs to happen at the beginning of the gestation that will influence whether the child develops into a male or a female. So you could say that gender is to some degree fluid at the beginning of the embryo, and she davens and it changes. Or maybe it's innate, I don't know. But what's more interesting for our purposes is the way this medrash is brought in the Targum Yonis. The Targum Yonis, a very ancient source, older than the Gemara in many ways, says the following. When it reports this idea of the switching, it gives a very different spin. Look what it says. 7. Notice on that pasuk says, Umin basar kedem. After this, yaladid brat. Brat is the Aramaic for a little girl. You can decide whether there's any connection there. Brat. Okay. But that's not for now. Okay. She had a little brat. Bat. Ukarat yat shma Dina. And she called her Dina. Why? Arum dinhu. Because she said it's a din. Min kadam Hashem. Dihon minei palget shvataya. I want to have 6 half the tribes. Baram min namachal achoyti yafkun train. And then from my sister Rachel should come at least 2 shvatim. Heich mudanavku min kadam min amata. Just like they came from the maidservants. The same story as we saw before. But now it's different. Ushma mikodem Hashem tzelusa de Leia. God heard Leia's prayers. Ve'itchalfu ubriya b'mayayihon. And he switched around the embryos in the womb. Not the gender, but the embryos, according to this. Rachel was originally carrying a girl, Dina, okay? And Leah was carrying a boy, which will be Yosef, and God switches the embryos in the room. The Hava Yahib Yosef, he now put Yosef b'maya the Rachel in Rachel's womb, and Dina b'maya the Leah. Now, that's interesting. What's that? Somehow or other, we now have a situation where you have a conception mother, a genetic mother, and a different birth mother. Yosef was originally Leah's child, but now he's born from Rachel, and they and Dina, vice versa. Is this relevant to our case? If anything, this would seem to indicate that who is the halachic mother, genetic or birth mother, which does this birth mother? Because if I ask anybody from now on, who is Yosef's mother, they'll tell me Rachel. They won't tell me, it's Rachel, though. And Dina is the daughter of Leah. And therefore, that would seem to be an indication for birth mother. However, it's not so straightforward, because there are other sources. If you look at the Torah, if you look at the Rosh on there, there is a very strange Chazal that says that Shimon married Dina later on. Shimon married Dina. Rashi brings this down. Okay? How can Shimon marry Dina? Shimon and Dina are full blood brothers and sisters, both the children of Yaakov and Leah. And even for a Noahite, it is unacceptable for a full brother to marry a full sister. Comes along the Torah and says, well, Dina's not really a full blood sister of Shimon, because really, Dina is the child of Rachel, because the embryos were switched, and therefore maybe, and once you get into that, you get into a whole new, and by the way, that raises a whole new, opens a whole Pandora's box, which is, were the Avot Jewish, or were they not Jewish? Were the Avot, were Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, were the Shvatim, were they Jewish? Did they go by Noahide laws, or by Halachic laws? That's an entire parsha. Yes, sir?
Yes. You talked about cloning. Say, for example, you got clones, and
okay, that's a good question. Save it for the share on cloning. We'll have a share on cloning at some stage. We'll save it for that. There are so many questions. So, Rachel and Leah and Yosef and Dina are a complicated parsha, not straightforward. And then we have to ask, is it legitimate to use this as a halachic source? This is an agadita. Somebody wants a halachic answer. Can you turn to something like this? Is that legitimate? Let's look at Esther. Number 8. Vayhi omein et Hadassah. Mordechai had adopted Hadassah. Okay, he Esther, that is Esther, bat dodo, she is his cousin. Ki ein la av ve'ein. She has no father and mother. V'hanari yifat to'ar v'sovat mar'eh. She was very beautiful. U'bumot avia ve'ima. And when her father and mother died, lekacha Mordechai lo lebat. Mordechai took her in as a daughter. Okay. The Gemara picks this up in Megillah and says, why does it say she had no mother and father, and then it says her mother and father died? Look in number 9. Ki ein la av ve'ein, ubemot avia ve'ima lamali. So why do I need to say her parents had died? You already told me she had no mother and father. I know her mother and father passed away. So the Gemara famously says, Amar Rav Acha, Ibrisa meis avia, when she was an embryo, when her mother conceived, her father passed away when her mother was pregnant. V'yadasa meisa ima, and her mother died in childbirth. Okay, mother died in childbirth. But what's interesting for us is Rashi, at the end of number 9 there, comes immediately and says, what does this mean, her mother died in childbirth? Ukashi yaldata ima meisa, when her mother died, she died in childbirth. V'loi nirit likrot aim. And she was never able to be called a mother. Now, according to Rashi, when is a woman called a mother of the child? A birth. Clearly this woman was pregnant with Esther, but that wasn't enough to call her a mother, says Rashi. She was called a mother only when she gave birth, and in this case she died in childbirth. She was never able to be called a mother. So there's another source, but again, that's an agadita. It is a midrashic source. And the question is, do we bring halachic proofs from agadatas? And let's just look at that question for a minute before we go back to surrogacy. Turn over to page 4, please. There is a statement in the Talmud Yerushalmi, number 10. Rabbi Zeira b'shem Shmuel says the following. Ein moirin loy min halachas, v'loy min agadas, v'loy min tosefta, ela min Talmud. You don't learn from Agadata, he says. We don't learn halachic conclusions from midrashic sources. Apparently so. And this is quoted by the Tosfos Yontef in number 11. He brings a midrashic idea. Tosfos Yontef is a classic commentary on the Mishnah. He brings at one point a midrashic idea, and he says, Achata shafti, but now I've changed my mind, he says, V'ra'iti she'ein lemeidim halacha mi-midrash rabbis. I'm not going to learn a halacha from a midrash, therefore let's leave it. So too the Node of Yehuda. The Node of Yehuda is presented with a fascinating case, which I think we've mentioned before, which has other implications halachically. The Node of Yehuda was presented with the following scenario. Back in the 18th century, there was a group of people which was hijacked on the road by highwaymen, and the head of the highwaymen said he was going to kill them all. And the woman, one of the women and one of the young women in the group, went privately to the hijacker, and she said to him, if I sleep with you, she was a married woman, will you save us? And he said, yes, and I'm a man of my word, and if that's what we do, then that's how it'll be. And she did, and he saved them, and they all went free. And the Shiloh went to the Node of Yehuda, was this in any way acceptable? Now, of course, it's well known, halachically, that you can do almost anything to save a life, or lives, but one of the things you can't do is commit adultery. The question, however, is what's with Esther? Because Chazal say that Esther was married to Mordechai, and yet she willingly gave herself up to Achashverosh to save the Jewish people. And the question the Node of Yehuda is dealing with is, can we learn from the case of Esther that if you're saving enough people, then you are allowed even to commit adultery? He deals with this question back and forth, but then he turns around and says, but you know something, this is a medrash, and we're not learning halacha from a medrash. Look at number 12. Hamidrashim v'ha'agadah, says the Nevi Huda, the midrashim and the agadah says, ikha kavanasam al ha'musa, they're there to teach us musa, v'ala ramazim, to hint at things, v'ala mashalim, and to give parables, shebahem v'hakol ikha hadat avva. This is all essential for Judaism, don't get me wrong, he says, take midrashim seriously, they teach important points, aval ein ikha kavanasam al piskei halachas. But that's not what they're for. They're not for halacha. I'm not going to use midrashim at all. By the way, this question of Esther, and this is off topic for today, is debated in a very interesting piece that came up a few years ago. In the Israeli media, there was a whole discussion, was, is it legitimate for Israeli spies, women spies, who are working underground and in the Mossad, is it legitimate for them to have sexual relations with somebody to get information which could be critical to the security of the Jewish state? And this debate brings in the whole Node of Yehuda and asks the question, etc. There was a whole discussion with Tzipi Livni at the time, I don't know if you remember, about whether this could happen, this would happen, this did happen, but that's part of this debate. However, it's not so straightforward. Nothing ever is it? Look in number 13. Having said that we can't use midrashim, have a look in number 13. The Rabbi Kiva Eger adds on there, he quotes the Tosfos Yontef, and then he says, listen, the Hapri Chadosh, the Sefer Mayim Chaim, in the Pri Chadosh, very important posek, in the Sefer Mayim Chaim, Hitzikal there, he objects to this. The Hach Klala Rakle Inyam Psak Halacha Divrei Mi. That's only, we don't learn midrashim in order to work out which way to paskin in a known halachic question. Where it's not clear in the Shas which way we paskin. Aval, dina, deloy, it parish for Shas. A din which we don't find at all in the Shas. A halacha which we can't find a classic source for. He says, matzinu kama pa'amin dana meidim in a midrashim. And he opens the door there to learn from midrashim in a situation where that's all we have. If we don't have a Gemara halachic source that deals with our scenario, so then maybe we can turn to Midrashim, and I brought you, I'm not going through it now, Rabbi Gadvaji Yosef in number 14 brings many sources that deal with this, that use Midrashim in different ways, and if you're interested, there's a very interesting article that I've referenced at the bottom by Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein. Emanuel Bernstein is, I'm sure many of you know Rabbi Bernstein, he's a very significant Talmud Chacham and a wonderful Magid Shir, and is a chip off the old block if you knew his father for sure, and he has a very good article in a journal which I've referenced here at the bottom. So can we learn from a Medrash? Maybe yes, maybe no, but actually we may not have to. Go over to page 5.
I want to bring you one more source that birth may be the answer, but this one actually comes not from a medrash, but from a bona fide halachic source. And this is the mitzvah of Yibum. Now this is where it gets a bit complicated, so this is where you have to listen. Not that you weren't listening before, but if you were thinking of not listening, this is where you have to for sure listen. This is the mitzvah of Yibum, as you know. If a woman marries a man, and unfortunately the man dies, and has no children, then the woman is halachically connected to the man's brother, and cannot just go off and marry somebody else until she deals with that connection. She can either classically marry the brother, that's called Yibum, the brother-in-law, which is unusual because brothers-in-law are chayv kares normally. A brother-in-law is incest. You cannot marry your husband's brother. If you got divorced from the husband and said, oh well, I'm divorced from him, but I quite like his brother, sorry, that's not acceptable. But in the case of Yibum, the mitzvah kicks in and overrides the issa. Or if she doesn't want to marry the brother, she does chalitza. Today we do chalitza, which is, we don't do Yibum on the whole. There are some posting that say you can do Yibum, but now we're a little suspect as to people's motivations, and therefore we do chalitza. Although, actually, I saw recently a tshuva discussing a case of a Yibum is very rare. Because Baruch Hashem, people normally have children and they don't normally die young, etc. But it does occasionally come up. I saw recently a situation, we now only do chalitza. There was a case of a chalitza that came up. Who was this with? I'm trying to remember who. I don't remember just now. Of a man who was the brother-in-law who had no legs. He was an amputee. And the shaila came up, how can you do chalitza in a situation where the man didn't have the legs in order to do put the shoe on and take the shoe off? You think, how likely could that be? It happens. And there's a whole discussion as to, oh, it's Rav Soloveitchik. It was Rav Soloveitchik. The shaila came to Rav Soloveitchik in America, and in that case they allowed Yibum, and they got divorced immediately, etc. Now, in our case, here's our scenario. I'm going to present you with three scenarios which the Gemara discusses, and you will by now know how to rule in those scenarios because we've discussed all the information. Again, in order for there to be Yibum, there has to be a brother. Okay? There has to be a brother. No brother, no Yibum. Okay? And technically it has to be a brother on the father's side. I'm not getting into all that now. If it's only a brother on the mother's side, also no Yibum. So here are the three scenarios. Scenario number one. Christine is non-Jewish, and she has two little boys, Roger and Patrick. And they all decide to become Jewish. So Christine and Roger and Patrick go to the mikveh, they become Jewish, and they come out, they're very happy, Hannah and Reuben and Pinchas, and they go. The boys grow up. The boys grow up and get married, one of them gets married at least, and then unfortunately dies, childless. And now the wife has to ask herself, do I or do I not have a question, a problem, an issue of Yibum? Does my dead husband have a brother, yes or no? And the answer is
no.
Because they are not related, because they're like a newborn child when they came out of the mikveh. That's clear. That's scenario number one in the Gemara. Easy. Scenario number two is also easy. Christine is not yet married, and she converts before she marries. She's a single girl. She's a single girl, she converts, she becomes Hanalea, whatever, and she now gets married, and she has children. She has little boys, and they grow up, one of them gets married and dies. Does the other brother, do they have a Yibum issue, yes or no?
Yes,
of course they do, because she converted. Once your person converts, they're 1,000% Jewish, and she gets married, and her children are totally Jewish children for all purposes. They are easy cases. The third case of the Gemara is the hard one. Christine is pregnant with two little embryos inside her, twin boys, Roger and Patrick. She could be very pregnant, 9 months pregnant, and she gives them the names. This is Roger, and this is Patrick. And she converts to Judaism when she's pregnant. And then a month later, or weeks later, the children are born. And they grow up, and they get married, and one of them dies. And the wife is now asking, do I not have a Yibum scenario? Did my late husband, have a brother, a halachic brother, yes or no? That's the hard case. So you're shaking your head saying no. Why no? Wait, they converted in the womb? But they were born Jewish. I understand that, but the babies, well, on the one hand, they were converts. They existed beforehand. We'll see there's a source coming up that the tefillah, the Gemara even asks how a pregnant woman can go to the mikveh to convert. Why isn't her body a chatzitza? something interposing between her and the children. And so the children clearly undergo tefillah, and yet they're born to a Jewish mother. Which is it going to be? If you think about it, the Gemara is presenting a case here. This is not midrashic. This could be happening at a mikveh near you. Okay? unlikely, because they don't usually allow 9-month pregnant women to convert to Judaism, because it opens up this whole Pandora's box. But this is not midrashic, this is a real halakhic scenario. So what's going to be? Are the ladies born Jewish because they have a Jewish mother at birth? Think about it. This Gemara is a scenario which is presenting a case where a child has two mothers. A non-Jewish conception genetic mother called Christine, and a Jewish birth mother called Hannah. Now, they are the same physical person, but they are two halachic people. Christine and Hannah are as far away as you can possibly imagine. Therefore, the Gemara is presenting, apparently, a case of a child with one birth mother and one genetic mother. And let's see what it says. So, the Gemara here says that in this scenario where the pregnant woman converts, the boys are brothers. They are brothers. For technical reasons, they don't do Yibum because they're not brothers on the father's side, but they are brothers. And if they were to marry their sisters-in-law, brothers-in-law, they're chayav, they're full brothers. Says Rashi, number 17. Number 16 is the case in the Gemara I just described. Number 17, Rashi says, why are they brothers? They're chayav kareis if they were to marry their in-laws without Yibum. Mishum eishes ach, because they are the brother, or the wife of the brother. Minayim, on the mother's side. Sheharei hi ki Yisraelit. Sheyalda banim. She is a Jewish woman who gave birth to children. And that's it. We're not worried that they were converted. We're not worried they used to be part of Christine. No. They are now Jewish babies, Jewish mother. And in that scenario, it sounds like the mother, halakhically, is the birth mother. So again, coming back to our surrogate situation, if you use a non-Jewish surrogate, then the children will be non-Jewish, and they will need to be converted, and if the father is a Kohen, the children will not be Kohenim, etc. If this is the case, by the way, now you know why we will use a non-Jewish surrogate rather than a Jewish surrogate. Because if we use a non-Jewish surrogate, and the children are all non-Jewish, if you like, and she does it for multiple families, well, that's fine, we can convert them, and they're not halakhically related. But if we use a Jewish surrogate, and the birth mother is the true mother, and she does this for multiple families, there could be siblings, like I mentioned before, all over the world, that didn't know they were related. And in the case that I was talking about before, they definitely used a non-Jewish surrogate. Now, I need to go on a little bit, because we have a few other things to get through before the end. So far, we've been talking about the birth mother being the mother. However, there are many, many sources, and I've just brought you a sprinkling here, to indicate that actually, no, maternity is set on conception. It's not the birth. For example, number 18. Tana Rabbanan, Shlosha Shutzvin Yeshva Adam. There are three partners in the creation of a human: HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Aviv, the Imoy. Okay? And it sounds like this is talking about a situation of conception. And there is a whole discussion as to when does the soul enter the body? Is it a conception? Is it shortly after? We'll get to that soon. But Rav Goren wanted to understand from that Gemara that actually the fatherhood and motherhood is fixed on conception. That what happens after that is not definitive. And there are other cases too. I mentioned to you the Gemara talks about a situation of a non-Jewish woman who converts when she's pregnant. A different Gemara from the one we saw before. And it says that the children undergo tefillah. The babies in the womb are having tefillah. Now, why do they need tefillah? Because they're not Jewish. Why are they not Jewish? Because they have a non-Jewish mother. It sounds like this Gemara, sounds like the motherhood is fixed, maybe at conception. But the most strange Gemara of all, and this is when I said to you earlier that it's going to be very strange, is number 20. Number 20 is talking about a case of Bechor. Okay? What's a Bechor? Now, you're familiar with a pigeon event. Somebody even mentioned it before. But Bechor is also for a kosher animal. Meaning, if I own a cow or a sheep, and they have a firstborn male calf or lamb, that firstborn is a Bechor. Okay? Back in the day, this was a big simcha. Everyone got very excited. Oh, it's a Bechor. You'll take it to the Kohanim. You'll go take it to the Beis HaMikdash. They'll bring it as a Korban. It'll be a big simcha. Everybody's happy. Today, it is actually a big pain in the neck to have a Bechor. Because there's no Kohanim to give it to. There's no Beis HaMikdash. But it's a Bechor. And there's nothing you can do with it. You can't shear it, you can't work it, you can't kill it, you can't eat it, you can't do anything. It just runs around the farm, owning the whole place, a wild animal, like a wildebeest, okay? And a wildebehemer maybe. So no one wants a bechor. So today there are all sorts of systems, they go into partnership with a non-Jew, so that it's partly owned. People do this, lemaisa, today in farms, if they have an animal, a kosher animal, and it's pregnant with its birth and it's a male, so they'll have a partnership with a non-Jew, so it won't really be a bechor. So the Gemara comes up with a fascinating solution. Look in number 20. Comes along this Talmudic farmer, and comes up with the following question. Hitbik shnei rachamim, v'yatsam izeven ichlasazeh. What's this farmer doing? This farmer has got two cows. One cow is heavily pregnant with a bechor. Let's call the cow Daisy. Okay? Daisy the cow is going to have a firstborn.
Jewish?
We don't know. Okay? We never ask, and we don't know. Okay? Daisy is having a bechor. And there's nothing we can do to stop that. The bechor is a bechor. It will be a firstborn male. That's a done deal. However, comes along the father and thinks, ooh, I've got an idea. I have another cow, let's call her Betsy, okay? And she's not pregnant at all. And she's eventually going to have a calf, and it could well be a bechor, it could be a male. Therefore, what we're going to do is going to do the following. Hit big shnei rachamim, we're going to back the two cows up, says the Gemara, next to each other. The yatsam izeh v'nichnas lezeh. The calf is going to come out of Daisy, and I'm going to engineer it, says the Gemara. I told you this was strange. So that it goes into the other cow, the non-pregnant cow. So now it can spend a little bit of time there, says the Gemara. Come out of that cow as well, and hey presto, we've now got two cows that have had a bechor. To mix the metaphor, I've killed two birds with one stone. Okay? I've used one calf for two cows. Brilliant. Brilliant Talmudic thinking. Leaving aside the problem, of course, that this is entirely impossible, which we'll get to in a second. Okay? This is a very interesting question. Mahu, what is the halacha? Look what the Gemara says. Didei patar, it definitely covers the bechor for its original mother. That's absolutely clear. Delav didei lo patar, but the second cow, Betsy, no, maybe not, that's not, it doesn't work for Betsy, she's not really the mother. Or Dilna, or maybe, delav didei, the one that's not the original one, nami patar, maybe it works for Betsy as well, teiku. Teiku means the Gemara is called like a draw. We don't know, it's a suffix, we're not clear, and we're not sure. But we know that the first cow works, but the second cow, question. Now, first of all, the commentators, classic commentators, ask on this Gemara, a Tosfos, as a Tosfos Subas, he says like this, look, I understand the need for strange, unusual cases, because they test the limits of the law. Yes. But this, he says, I'll show you the Tosfos, it's not on the sheet. He said, why? I mean, it's impossible. Everybody knows this is impossible. Believe me, if you don't think this works, they knew more about farming probably than most people here. And it doesn't work. You cannot get a child into a non-pregnant female cow. Please don't try that anywhere, okay? Because you'll get into trouble with the police, okay? It doesn't work. So Tosfos says, well, the rabbis have nothing else to do but kind of think up cases that don't work. And you know, Tosfos eventually concludes, I don't know. Maybe it's just here for us to have Talmud Torah. Just Talmud Torah. We get schar for learning Torah. But frankly, practical application. It could never happen. That was in the 12th century. But today, in the 21st century, things have changed. This Gemara is talking about taking embryos out from genetic mothers, placing them into non-genetic, purely birth gestational mothers, and asking, who is the mother? And this Gemara is saying that the birth mother may not be the mother, because she's not connected enough with the calf. The fact that it was in there, technically, and came out again, is not enough. Therefore, this Gemara now is a classic source. It's a key source. The whole question of taking embryos from here and putting them there. Now, we don't yet do this exactly how this, I mean, we don't have surrogacy where women get pregnant and then we take it out from one woman and put it into another. But would you put money on the fact that they'll never do this? I wouldn't put money on that. You could have babysitting during pregnancy. Okay? She'll carry for 3 months, then she'll give it to her sister for 3 months, she'll give it to her sister for 3 months. Is that any weirder than the stuff that we can already do? And therefore the Gemara is talking about that, and it could be, and that seems to be a case, Araya, proof that the conception mother is the mother. There's an even more difficult scenario. We'll finish with this in a second, go over the page. It could be that there are two halachic mothers. We've assumed up until now that actually it's either this or that. Just look for a second at number 22. I've quoted you from an article by Rabbi Gideon Weissman. Rabbi Gideon Weissman is a fascinating individual. He is one of the halachic directors of Pua, of Machon Pua, which of course is right at the cutting edge of this issue. And he wrote a very interesting article recently in a journal which I'm quoting from here. Number 22, he says, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is famously quoted as saying that he found a source in the voluminous rabbinic literature for every question that was posed to him, including all medical and technological advances, barring one. Namely, the question of determining motherhood in a surrogacy case. Therefore, Rabbi Auerbach stated that we must be strict in both directions. When the egg donor is not Jewish, the child requires conversion. And when the birth mother, the gestational carrier, is not Jewish, the child also requires conversion. Meaning, maybe they are both the mother. And actually, there are sources that indicate that way. Number 21 is, I'm not going through in detail because we don't have enough time, but the scenario is this. Let's say I have a tree, which is an orla tree. It's only 2 years old, and it's producing fruit. What if I take the branch off an orla 2-year-old tree and graft it into a 20-year-old tree and allow it to continue its growth? When I pick the fruit, is that fruit from an orla tree or is that fruit from an old tree? Which is it? Or is it both? Meaning, which is the mother, the 2-year-old tree or is it the older tree? And in fact, the Gemara concludes both, and they have a few other examples like that. So it could be that a person could have two mothers. And maybe two mothers-in-law, in due course, that would be from the same girl. Okay, that's something to think about. But maybe there are indeed two mothers. That's one possibility, which of course raises a fascinating further question: if one of the two mothers is Jewish and the other one is not Jewish, so what does that make the child? Meaning, are you Jewish if you have a Jewish mother, or are you not Jewish if you have a non-Jewish mother? Okay. Well, I don't know about that, I doubt it. But the point is that it could be some kind of half-Jewish. We always tell people you can't be half-Jewish. You're either, well, maybe you can. Okay? And finally, I brought some other issues here just to take you through the sheet, and we're not going to finish them all. There is a question as to what happens before 40 days gestation. There are sources that indicate that until 40 days gestation in the womb, what we have is not yet really an embryo, it's just a potential embryo. That has implications for abortion, but also for this case. Maybe we're not interested in what happens before then. There's a shyness to whether IVF creates parenthood at all. Almost all posts can say it does. Tetzeliezer was particularly on a limb on that one. On page 7, I brought you a little summary of who says what. Most poskim historically said that birth determines the status. I brought you Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, he was very insistent that it's birth. Rav J. David Bleich, I mentioned Rav Eliashiv, although Rav Eliashiv says it was offered to do it, you shouldn't have done it in the first place, but it's birth at the end of the day. Rav Moshe Tendler, but others say no. Rav Avadia, Rav Yaakov Ariel say it's genetics, and more rabbis are now saying it's genetics based on sources that we have seen and many sources that we haven't seen. The last thing I just wanted to mention before we finish is, and you can read this in your own time, I brought you at the end a piece from Rabbi Ezra Bick from Gush Etzion. And I've actually mentioned this before when we talked about something else, but he asked the question that are we really looking in the right place for the answers to these questions? Look, basically he says the Gemara doesn't deal with it. We can find amazing technical sources that seem to indicate this and seem to indicate that, but bottom line, the Gemara doesn't ask this question directly. And therefore, maybe we should be looking not at technical halachic or maybe even agadic sources, but more broader hashgafic principles that the Gemara brings as to work out what does the Jewish tradition say from Chazal about maternity, about paternity. You can read the piece and see it's actually very interesting as to whether we should, in some cases, look slightly differently at the sources for halacha than technically and traditionally we always did. So there we are. Just a sprinkling, an introduction to that. Hopefully it was of interest, because I think these are cases that will appear more and more and more. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, I want to speak about astrology, mazal, and the occult.